This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There are also some more tensions up north where after an apparent missile strike by Hezbollah or that came from Syria, Israel struck Syria and Hezbollah says seven of its members were killed.
That was reporter Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem on the latest from the Israeli-Hamas conflict. Details coming up also. The UN Refugee Agency says thousands of people are fleeing Sudan's volatile Darfur region, and South Africa says any citizen who goes to Israel to fight Hamas could face prosecution. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said today he welcomed Israel's agreeing to daily humanitarian pauses in its offensive in northern Gaza, but also said far too many Palestinians have died and suffered in the month-old conflict. Fighting has raged in northern Gaza since Hamas gunmen poured over the border into Israel on October 7th and, according to Israeli officials, killed 1,400 people and seized about 240 hostages. Israel has retaliated with an aerial bombing and ground offensive that the health ministry in the Hamas-run Gaza Strip says has killed more than 11,000 people, many of them children. Our reporter in Jerusalem, Linda Gradstein, briefed me on the latest a little while ago.
Well, first of all, there's heavy fighting in Gaza. The Israeli troops have reached the perimeter of the Shifa hospital, and Palestinians say that there was tank fire. The Israeli army is not confirming it, and there are hundreds of people who are sheltering in the Shifa hospital or patients who can't be moved. Israel has warned Palestinians to evacuate all of the hospitals in northern Gaza and says that Hamas is using the underneath the hospital and has built a bunker and a command center. There are also some more tensions up north where after an apparent missile strike by Hezbollah or that came from Syria, Israel struck Syria and Hezbollah says seven of its members were killed. So it seems that both the fighting is intensifying in Gaza in the south and tensions between Israel and Hezbollah in the north.
The Hamas government actually today said that Israeli airstrike on the territory's largest hospital killed 13 people. But the Israeli army, like you mentioned, has repeatedly accused Hamas of using hospitals, particularly Al-Shifa, you know, to coordinate their attacks against the army.
That's right. And Israel has, Israel has repeatedly said that everybody should leave. And in the last few days, thousands of Palestinians who were still in northern Gaza, despite Israeli warnings to leave, have fled to the south. Israel says Hamas is using people and patients in the hospitals as human shields. Palestinians deny the fact, the Israeli accusation that Hamas has a bunker underneath the hospital. They say that Israel's just making this up and is just using it as a way to target civilians.
The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken actually said today he welcomed Israel agreeing to daily humanitarian pauses in its offensive in northern Gaza.
Yes. I mean, Israel has, you know, continued to say that it does not want to hit the civilians in Gaza, that its target is Hamas and the Hamas leadership, and that they have killed dozens of high-ranking Hamas people, that they have hit 130 tunnels and have hit some 15,000 Hamas targets in terms of infrastructure and things like that in Gaza. That said, Gaza is a very densely populated area, and according to the Palestinian Health Ministry, the death toll is something like 10,800, including thousands of children. So, you know, I think the United States is growing increasingly concerned about the humanitarian situation and the growing death toll of civilians, and hopes that these humanitarian pauses are sort of the first step towards a ceasefire. Now, Israel says there cannot be a ceasefire until all of its 240 hostages are released. There are talks going on and have been going on with Egypt and Qatar to try to do some sort of limited hostage release in exchange for a temporary ceasefire. I just saw, by the way, that according to the health ministry, and again, it's affiliated with Hamas, the death toll has crossed 11,000 since the war began on October 7th. They're saying, according to the health ministry, it includes 4,500 children and more than 27,000 people have been wounded.
And lastly, Linda, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at first kind of said, controlling Hamas, the security. But now, basically, he's saying we do not seek to govern Gaza. We do not seek to occupy, but we seek to give it, a better future.
Yes, except that Israel never really intended to reoccupy Gaza. It doesn't want to have to provide municipal services to a very poor population of 2.2 million people, more than a million of whom are Palestinian refugees. Netanyahu has also said that Israel will have to maintain security control of Gaza, at least for a while. What seems to be shaping up is some sort of international consortium, which would help the Palestinian Authority, which controls the West Bank, to run Gaza. The Palestinian Authority says it will only do so in the context of the two-state solution, meaning an independent Palestinian state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, which really does not seem very likely, at least in the short term.
That was our journalist Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. In South Africa, law enforcement agencies say some of the country's citizens have joined the Israeli Defense Force, the IDF, to fight the Hamas militant group. The South African government has responded by declaring their actions illegal and saying any citizen fighting for foreign forces will be considered a mercenary and will be prosecuted. Darren Taylor reports.
Jewish organizations say many members of South Africa's Jewish community have in the past served in the Israeli army. Intelligence agencies have told VOA some South Africans have now returned to Israel to take up arms against Hamas. They join thousands of other people from around the world that have joined the Israeli Defense Force since fighting began. On October 7, Hamas militants attacked Israel, killing about 1,400 people and taking more than 200 hostages back with them to the Gaza Strip. Israel responded by vowing to wipe out Hamas and by bombing and blockading Gaza. Palestinian officials say Israel's attacks have killed nearly 11,000 people, including about 4,000 children. In an audio statement on his Facebook page, South Africa's chief rabbi, Warren Goldstein, claimed positions taken by President Cyril Ramaphosa's administration motivated South African Jews to want to fight for Israel.
And in its most recent actions, withdrawing South African diplomats from Israel and threatening the Israeli ambassador to South Africa with expulsion, this government is supporting Iran and its proxies, Hamas and Hezbollah, to destroy the state of Israel and spread global jihad.
So says Goldstein, South African Jews have the right to defend their brothers and sisters in Israel. Not so, says Minister in the Presidency, Kumbuzo Nchaveni. She's warned that the Foreign Military Assistance Act prohibits any South African from participating in military operations in other parts of the world. South Africa's government has been sympathetic to the Palestinian cause since the early days of the post-apartheid government. Pretoria has called for a ceasefire in the conflict and has called on the International Criminal Court to issue an arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for war crimes. Darren Willifier, a military historian who writes for the African Defense Review, says the government's warning is unlikely to deter South Africans from joining the Israeli military. He says the government doesn't have the resources to track them and they simply return home when they wish.
There hasn't been a single case of that being successfully prosecuted. This is something that exists on the books, but it's probably unenforceable in its current form. It's quite difficult to prevent a citizen from doing this. It would require a level of surveillance on what South Africans are doing abroad, and it would require cooperation from the host countries. On top of that, you then need to be sure that they're involved in a conflict, which requires even more information. What you are reduced to is policing based on footage that comes out, or photographs that come out. And each one of those then requires its own discretion into, well, is the person in dual prison?
Willie Furu says South Africans have served in the Israeli armed forces since Israel's War of Independence in 1948. Willie Furu points out that many South African Jews also have Israeli citizenship, giving them the right to join the IDF. He says other African countries have anti-mercenary laws, but mostly fail to enforce them and sometimes even disregard their own regulations. As an example, he cites Nigeria, which in 2015 used hundreds of South African and Russian private soldiers to fight the terror group Boko Haram. In addition, several countries use mercenaries from Russia's Wagner group. Many governments, including the United States, do not bar their citizens from joining the military in other countries and also allow foreign nationals to join their armed forces. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Africa's foreign ministry says the ambassador of Israel was called in today to discuss what it called his unfortunate conduct concerning the conflict. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, warns thousands of people are fleeing Sudan's volatile Darfur region amidst escalating violence and human rights violations. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UNHCR says more than 8,000 people have fled into neighboring Chad in the last week alone. The United Nations Refugee Agency says this latest exodus was triggered by attacks by armed groups in Adamawa, West Darfur, an area that was considered relatively safe until now. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler tells VOA more than 800 people reportedly were killed. He says armed men attacked a camp for internally displaced people, razing nearly 100 shelters to the ground. He says they went on a rampage, engaging in widespread violence against the civilian population and extensively looting the area, including UNHCR relief items, prompting people to flee for their lives.
Recently, we saw people arriving from this area in Chad, many refugees who were wounded and with gunshot wounds, and who reported that in this area of Adamawa, armed militias were going house to house, killing men, youth, and boys.
Spindler says the UNHCR also has received reports that men and boys arriving at checkpoints were prevented from fleeing. He says other reports indicate that thousands of internally displaced people have had to flee a camp in El Janina. Media report there's been a surge in ethnically driven killings since the paramilitary rapid support forces captured the Sudanese army headquarters in West Darfur's state capital, El Janina, on November 4th. Spindler says newly arriving refugees in Chad recount alarming tales of atrocities they witnessed.
We have interviewed many of these refugees who are telling us harrowing stories of sexual violence, of people being killed by armed groups, of specific ethnic groups being targeted, of civilians being extorted, of torture, and other gross human rights violations.
3 days ago, Sudan's warring parties promised to abide by a plan adopted at the Jeddah peace talks to protect civilians and provide them with unimpeded humanitarian access. The UNHCR and other agencies say those promises must be kept. Since conflict erupted April 15th between the Sudanese armed forces and the RSF, the UNHCR reports 4.8 million people have become newly displaced inside Sudan and 1.2 million have fled as refugees to neighboring countries, including 450,000 to Chad. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Mali's army says it fired on two armored vehicles left behind by the United Nations peacekeeping mission as it withdrew last week. The vehicles had been quickly taken over by rebels in the strategic northern town of Kidal. before the peacekeeping force known as MINUSMA hurriedly abandoned its base in Kidali last week. MINUSMA said it had been forced to destroy vehicles, ammunition, generators and other gear to keep it from falling into the wrong hands after the ruling military council imposed the restrictions on moving the equipment. Joseph Siegel, director of research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi who gains from the Malian government's restrictions.
It's really unclear what the Malian junta gains from this. By best accounts, it seems to have been a strategic miscalculation on their part. It may have been that the junta felt that by restricting the UN's departure and forcing it to leave all of its equipment, that Malian military would be able to take over these bases and gain control over that equipment. Yet it seems the military overestimated its capabilities because it can't even reach into Kidal and to these other bases. So it can't fill the gap that has been created by the withdrawal of the UN forces. Moreover, these restrictions seem very much aimed at undermining the UN operation. They prevented aerial support for the UN operations, and so very much putting the UN forces at risk for making some sort of methodical withdrawal from the north. So it's very hard to see who gains from this. The only potential winner in this is Russia, who the Malian junta brought in through the Wagner group as a means of helping to prop up the regime. And you know, Russia potentially gains because Mali has now alienated all of its historical partners in the region with Europe. This has created a vacuum that Russia hopes to fill. And so it may be that Russia sees this as a geostrategic win, but it really is a threat to the civilian population in Mali and potentially could result in the collapse of the Malian state.
Kidal is a Tuareg stronghold from which rebels have long fought for autonomy for the desert region they call Azawad, was a potential flashpoint now that the United Nations has left. It's not clear how well positioned the Malian army is to take back this base. What are the security ramifications of Tuareg taking over the vacated UN base in Kidal?
In the short term, it doesn't pose an immediate security threat. The Tuareg have not initiated any military action against the Malian military. So that hasn't been the main aspect of the conflict, which has been primarily driven by the violent extremist groups. And we should remember that the Tuareg were aligned with the Malian government since 2015 with the Algiers Accord, and they have been working together against the violent extremist groups since that time. It's with the Malian junta's decision to push the UN peacekeeping force out of the north that the Tuaregs have felt abandoned, and now they are filling the vacuum that has been left by the UN withdrawal. What the Tuareg do at this point, I think, remains to be seen. Again, they haven't indicated or initiated any military action against the Malian government. It would seem their initial concern would just be self-protection because, you know, they are vulnerable to the violent extremist groups themselves. It may be that they strike a deal with the violent extremist groups, a mutual, you know, non-aggression sort of pact, and that would create some degree of protection for the Tuareg. So we will have to see how that plays out. At this point, I don't see that the Tuareg taking over the bases provides an immediate security threat. However, it will likely be seen very negatively by the Malian junta, who will resent Tuareg aspirations for autonomy in the north. And in that sense, it may open up another front of fighting where you have a civil conflict between the Malian military and the Tuareg militias, in addition to the ongoing and escalating fighting we're seeing with the violent extremist groups.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. Zambian authorities say trade between the country and China increased to more than $5 billion in 2022. The increased trade, however, has brought an influx of Chinese products into local markets. Some Zambians appreciate the increased choices of products available, but others aren't happy about the competition the products present. Kathy Short reports from Lusaka, Zambia.
John Zingala is one of the traders at Lusaka's Chachacha market in Zambia. He sells hardware products imported from South Africa. He used to sell clothing but quit after he discovered he could not compete with cheaper Chinese textiles. Ngala says business is tough.
Previously, I was doing selling clothing, and I later adjusted to start selling a hardware to re-establish my business after being hit by these Chinese cheap products on the market.
Isaac Mwape, another trader in Lusaka, sells electronic products imported from China. He seems happier with the imports.
China is producing every type of good that you want. Like, we are selling phones, you see, we are selling laptops. They are very good.
Consumers on the streets of Lusaka also have a mix of opinions about Chinese imports.
I prefer Western products because they are durable. Chinese products, it's a no because they are not durable and they are cheap.
I'm in support of China to be closer with us because China has been always there for us, we as Africans.
Emmanuel Zulu, an economist, says countries like Zambia have not benefited fully from Chinese investments. He would like to see Zambian and Chinese authorities focus more on bringing not just goods to Zambia, but also skills and manufacturing to ensure a win-win situation for both countries.
Well, it has helped to provide accessibility to products that are not locally produced. And also, it has also provided stiff competition for products that are locally produced in Zambia. And to some degree, it has also led to non-development of the industrial base in Zambia.
Zambian President Hakainde Hichilema, on a state visit to Beijing in September, signed several bilateral agreements with China aimed at strengthening cooperation between the two countries. Zambian Commerce, Trade and Industry Minister Chipoka Mlenga told VOA in a telephone interview Monday that his government is working closely with Chinese authorities to set up manufacturing plants and skills transfer for Zambians in the fields of mining, electronics, textiles and agriculture. Kathy Short, VOA News, Lusaka, Zambia.
Kenya says it will not deploy its police officers to Haiti until all conditions on training and funding are met. Officials say those conditions must be in line with last month's approval from the United Nations Security Council to give the Eastern African country command of a multinational mission to fight violent gangs. Interior Minister Kithure Kindiki said yesterday that UN member states are securing resources and have identified how funds would be mobilized and made available to Kenya for the mission. The Associated Press says it was not immediately clear when the forces would be fully trained and funded to allow for deployment. Meanwhile, Haiti is reporting a fresh round of gang-related killings and kidnappings as it awaits help. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Jumbe Hamza, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.